I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. U.S. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is not happy about the president's latest budget proposal and hasn't been shy about letting us know. Today, while he's in town from Washington, a conversation with Kansas City's veteran congressman. We'll ask him about a House Democratic Party that's back in the majority and any prospects for working with Republicans. Then, Sarah McBride was the first openly transgender speaker at a major political convention. She's currently an activist for the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. We'll hear her story and learn what challenges today's transgender people face. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is in a new position in Washington these days. He's a member of the majority party in the U.S. House of Representatives. That means more clout and more responsibility. Last week, he was speaking out about President Trump's latest budget, and the congressman was none too happy. He said the president's budget demonstrates a severe lack of empathy or understanding of how these cuts will hurt the people of this country. He also chaired his first Financial Services Subcommittee dealing with anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing legislation. Chairing committees is a privilege of the majority party. Congressman Cleaver joins us now. And Congressman, always good to have you.
Good to be here with you.
I'm wondering, as we start out here, if you would give us maybe just something of an overview of where you see the country now in this third year of President Trump. What are your concerns? Where do you see things right now across the country?
Well, I think there's a great deal of disruption in government, period. And unfortunately, it is going to hurt the entire country. The president's put out his budget, which I think is a cocktail of bad ideas. But the worst part about it is that I fear that the most significant piece of legislation that should be brought forth is a transportation bill or an infrastructure bill, which the president does put in his budget, but we need $1 trillion transportation or infrastructure bill. He's talking about a $3 billion deal. And that's anybody who drives around these streets in Kansas City understands clearly that we're going to do enormous damage to automobiles and so forth. But I think there's so much chaos that we may not be able to get anything done like transportation. Now, earmarks are back on the table, mm-hmm. and that could very well swing the issue of infrastructure into play, because every district is like my district, and there are serious problems like Buck O'Neill Bridge, and like we have I-70 torn up, and you hit potholes on the federal highway. I've got bridges in Marshall and Lexington that need to be replaced. Everybody's got those same problems. So we may be able to get a transportation bill. I'm not sure.
And you say the earmarks are these individual appropriations that members of Congress, pots of money that you guys have some control over.
Right.
Yeah. That might be coming back, you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think people realize that they were suckered into stopping earmarks. And all we did was give the executive branch Article 2 powers. Mm-hmm. We have the right of the purse, and we gave it away as we're giving away so much more, including right now President Trump's violation, I think, a constitutional violation, being turned down by Congress on a request and then taking money to go and do a wall without congressional approval. And I think even though both houses voted to refuse to allow him to do that, he's going to do it anyway by declaring an emergency.
The danger of that going forward is what in your mind, Congressman?
Well, I know people who listen to this not going to want to agree with this. It leads toward an imperial presidency, and it's been moving in this direction for some time. Just think about this one fact. Since 1942, the United States has not declared a single war, and yet we have over 118,000 Americans who've been killed on battlefields in undeclared wars. So how did that happen? Well, the Constitution is clear. Congress must declare war. Presidents are supposed to have some authority to act quickly. So you send troops somewhere for 60 days. And then we are supposed to, then the president's supposed to come back.
Mm-hmm.
That's a part of the 1972 War Powers Act.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that never happens anymore. So we're just constantly giving the executive branch more and more authority. And earmarks was one of those things. We gave presidents the authority. When we had the economic collapse in 2008, I'm on the committee that voted to make money available for what's called neighborhood stabilization, where because we were averaging about 1,000 foreclosures a week. So we appropriated this money so that cities could go into communities that were devastated by foreclosure and stabilize it, boarding up windows and so forth. Well, when they announced the first batch of funding in Neighborhood Stabilization 1, NSP, Neighborhood Stabilization Program, there was not one single dollar appropriated for Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, flyover territory. And Kit Bond and I had to go down and confront the HUD secretary. Didn't matter whether he was a Democrat or a Republican, happened to be a Democrat. But, you know, and so the people in this part of the country ought to be the last people to want decisions made about their tax dollars by somebody they'll never vote for.
Yeah. This idea of calling the new federal budget, Congressman, a cocktail of bad ideas, what are you referring to?
Well, the president is beating up on some of the people that who vote for him, and they probably still will vote for him. I mean, we're talking about some dramatic cuts in the agricultural bill. We're talking about cuts with Medicare. We're talking about cuts in areas for urban America, like in community development block grants. And then the cuts were made so that he could, again, put money in the budget for a wall.
Mm-hmm.
That based on all the polling data, the wall is not approved by the majority of the American public.
But they're he says the wall is needed because of dangers that lurk if we don't build that wall. This country is under assault through illegal immigration, he says.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Texas. All my family is there, probably 150 Cleavers down there. None of them are running around afraid because of an invasion. But even more importantly, the statistics. I'm on the Homeland Security Committee, and we're constantly getting information about all of the threats. We get what's called a threat assessment. And there is no threat on the southern border. It's his Homeland Security Department. Now, we had the Secretary of Homeland Security before our committee last week, and she's going to, of course, go to the line of the president. But everybody knows that all of the drugs that are coming in, the majority of the drugs, are at the points of entry. That's what we need to beef up, points of entry with more sophisticated data. More sophisticated means of detection, and we don't have that.
How can it be that the president of the United States is constantly saying that we're under threat because of our open borders, and you're sitting here today as a member of the Homeland Security Committee saying it's not so?
It's not so, and anybody listening to this broadcast can go and get the threat assessment for the southern border. It's publicly available, and you will read that there is no threat, The intelligence community recently appeared before the House, one of the House committees on intelligence, and not one federal agency, the president's cabinet, said that we were threatened at the southern border, not the FBI, not the CIA. I mean, nobody.
Mm-hmm.
This was a manufactured crisis. And the president, unfortunately, made a campaign pledge that he was going to build this beautiful wall and that the Mexicans were going to pay for it.
Congressman Emanuel Cleaver from Missouri's 5th District is my guest. You also mentioned this infrastructure idea. You know, that seems to be an idea that has had, you know, support from both Democrats and Republicans now going back for a number of years. Why are we so slow to get to that idea? Because, again, it has such broad bipartisan support. You think the president and so many members of Congress would be hopping aboard that train right now.
Well, I failed to mention when we talked about it earlier. In the president's budget, he puts such a low figure in there for the infrastructure bill because he says that the rest of the funding must come from the local community and the state. Well, the state of Missouri is that's I mean,
there's no money to be had there.
No,
yeah,
and to expect us to go to Hallmark Cards and Kansas City Power and Light and say, we want you to give us money to rebuild the federal highway system. I mean, they're going to laugh me out of the office. Mm-hmm. I would never do it. So the reason we can't get together on it, I think, in part, because of earmarks. And one of the reasons is, for example, if somebody thinks I'm going to vote for a transportation bill and I have no idea what the people of the 5th District are going to get, and then I'm going to get criticized, and rightfully so, you know, well, our congressperson doesn't have any influence because they just approved a transportation bill. We didn't get anything for our community. Hmm. And so every member of Congress is thinking, you know, we need a bill, but boy, if I don't bring something home, I'm not going to be able to vote for this.
But what's stopping the president, congressman, from going after this $1 trillion package that you're outlining here? So, again, so many members of both parties have said that's what we need.
Well, I think the president, unfortunately, is preoccupied with some other things. And you know,
The Mueller investigation,
yes,
you're referring
to.
Yes,
the Mueller.
Yeah.
But there's something to be said about experience. You know, experience matters, particularly in the political arena. And so you become the leader of the world, essentially, when you become president of the United States. And you got to have some kind of a vision, and you also have to know how to work with both parties. President Clinton lost, just as did President Trump, the House when he was after his first term, but he was able to get all kinds of things approved because he worked with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't call people names and sit down and talk to them about a deal. And you can't go out and look. One of the things, if you tell somebody that you're going to be for something in Washington, and you bail on them, whether you're in Congress or in the House or the Senate, doesn't matter. Henceforth and forevermore, people are going to stand back. And so, the president told us before Christmas 2 years ago that we had a deal on the budget, and then he backed away from it. And so now everybody's saying, even if you strike a deal, the president is going to back up if Rush Limbaugh or Ann Coulter or mm-hmm. others say that it's a bad deal.
Again, Congressman Cleaver is my guest. You just mentioned the Mueller probe, Congressman, which appears, again, I underline the word appears, to be finally reaching an end here. There are indications that's happening. What do you expect that report's going to tell us? And will the American people have a chance to read it?
Well, one of the things I believe that former Mayor Giuliani is right on, he said the Mueller report is going to be so horrible that the American people are going to be scared. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him. I think that people who are saying, well, there's no collusion, there's no this and there's no that, have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. I mean, and if you talk to Adam Schiff or Benny Thompson or
Adam Schiff, who's leading the Democratic side of this probe.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Or Judiciary or Elijah Cummings in investigations. I mean, they'll tell you they have no idea what's in that report because Mueller's team has been, absolutely silent, mm-hmm. and nobody knows what's going to come out. I don't think it's going to be good. It may not be impeachable because, I mean, bad stuff is not necessarily illegal stuff.
Has Mueller, his team, given Congress any sense of a timeline here as to when the report might be coming?
No. And I remember a couple of weeks ago, people were saying the report is going to come out next week. And all of us in Washington are saying, what? I mean, where did that come from? I mean,
do you think it's just going to show up one day? Is that what the expectation is? That it's a Tuesday morning and it's 10 o'clock and there it is?
I think one day we'll have the Attorney General make a statement that we're going the Mueller report will be presented to Congress in 2 weeks or whenever. I think people are making a mistake when they say it's winding down. And one of the reasons that I think it's a big mistake is Mueller just indicted one additional individual who has not gone to trial, and I don't think his trial is set until next fall. I think it's next November. And so I think we're going to be around for a while. Now, I think the Southern District of New York may come out before the Mueller report, and I think that is going to be devastating to the president. Now,
the betting line is that action by those folks, those law enforcement folks, might be more damaging to the president than even the Mueller report might
yes,
be
but,
in terms of indictments and legal action going forward.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, and also keep in mind, we don't know today whether there are sealed indictments now that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're sealed would mean we're not going to know about them. And I think Mueller is I'd love to see him watch him play chess, because I think this – I mean, I've heard about how methodical he is, and I've just kind of watched from the distance, and now on Homeland Security. This man is a mastermind, and I wouldn't mess with him.
You know, there's some conversation about whether the public will have access to this report, and Congress has been taking a look at that. What do you anticipate happening on that front?
Well, I think Attorney General Barr has said that, you know, he wants to do what's right. He wants to give the public as much as he can legally give.
Mm-hmm.
The American public will never be satisfied until they know everything that happened as it relates to Russian interference in our last election. And so ultimately, we may have to file suit. We being the House of Representatives, the next president. Presidents have the ability to declassify anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine that the next president is going to declassify it one way or another, because I the American public deserves to know everything that happened, I think.
Again, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver is my guest. You know, different topic, Congressman. How is it for you to be back in the majority again? I mean, this has got to be like breathing fresh air after being stuck in a closet for a very long time for you.
Well, yes. I used to get up every morning. I live right across the street from the House. I live closer to the House of Representatives than any other member of Congress.
Is that right?
I live in the Methodist building, which is the only non-government building on the Mall. The Methodist, our church, bought it back in 1925, built this building that for $3 million, I think they can sell it for $200 million now. And so I live in this building. It's an office building, but I converted some offices into apartments. I walk across the street. I walked across the street for years to vote, to lose every vote. I mean, you know, when you get up in the morning, just think about that. If you came to KCUR, and you know that every morning you got there, that the microphones weren't going to work. It's just not
not going to be a good day. Yeah.
So that's how I went to work every day. The microphones are not going to work.
Yeah. You know, you just were able to announce that a new visitor center will be built in Independence for the Harry S. Truman historic site. Tell us about that, because people on that side of our listening area will be interested in this.
Well, the Truman House, which is on actually now Truman Road,
mm-hmm.
has needed a visitor center, and so there's some vacant property that we've been able to secure, and now we have the funds that we will proceed to build this visitor center.
This is going to be near the president's
residence,
former home.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
right off Truman Road,
mm-hmm.
And we received a lot of calls because a lot of people thought that it was the Grandview home. which we have got to do the same thing out there because
right. his old farm out there,
the farm that he actually lost in bankruptcy, but was able to come back and reacquire it. So that's a big deal because getting anything done with spending right now is very, very difficult. We also are trying desperately to get something done at Quindaro, which we had in the same legislation. However, we did not get any money for the Quindaro project.
That's over on the Kansas side.
Right outside of Kansas City, KCK. It's an old slave village.
Right.
And Sharice Davis came right in working with me to get that done. Kevin Yoder had started the project with me.
If you have questions for the Congress, we have them for a few more minutes. 816-235-2888 is our number. Last week, you chaired your first hearing as chair of the new U.S. House Financial Services Subcommittee on National Security, International Development, and Monetary Policy. That's a lot of words. What's the committee's mission?
It's a lot of work. The one thing I need to tell you about the majority. I was telling some of my colleagues, I said, boy, this majority thing, that means you don't get any sleep.
is that right?
We're going all day long. But we have the responsibility right now, and it's one of these times that's pregnant with opportunities for hearings more than we would like, to deal with a lot of cryptocurrency issues where people are moving money around without dealing with real money. And we're having difficulty, as one might imagine, with overseas banks and non-banks moving money around. And it creates the perfect opportunity for money laundering. And so we have the responsibility of dealing with all those issues. In addition to the World Bank, the IMF, and the Ex-Im Bank.
Hey, how vulnerable is this country to financial crimes right now? What's your sense?
We have institutions that are fighting off attempts all day long you're talking about a real invasion of criminals around the world trying to hit us for money, and sometimes they are successful. I'm aware. I can't call the name of an organization that just got hit really bad, and it's happening every single day. There are people. I met with some.
This is all digital electronic stuff we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Invisible money, bitcoins, and so I was with some former undercover agents in my office last Tuesday, I think, and they were filling me in on some things that were going on. They now work with one of our largest banks in the country, one of the largest banks in the country, and they have now set up an entire department of a lot of people who do nothing but come in and fight off attempts from people stealing our money.
Wow.
Every day.
That might keep you up at night a little bit.
It does, and especially when you know, one of the bad things about being in the majority and being a chair is that you get this information and a lot of it is scary. I almost wanted to go tell my family member, get your money, put it under the mattress. But I think the FBI, if you get an FBI agent here, they'll tell you what's happening every single day.
Wow.
And we're not able to stop all of the attacks. I mean, North Korea, for example, that has been one of their only means of bringing in dollars or money, is stealing it from around the world and from us, from the United States.
I want to get you on one other thing I thought was significant. You just oversaw the passage of an important piece of housing legislation, Congressman. It'll allow low-income families to relocate to low-poverty areas. You say this is a step forward when it comes to breaking what you call this generational cycle of poverty that has plagued too many American families for too long. Your words there. Tell us about this bill.
Well, I have a photograph on my wall in Washington, and everybody comes in, sees this photograph. It's the house that my mother, father, my three sisters, and I lived in. It's a shack.
Down in Texas. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have one in my office here. We moved out of that shack into public housing. We lived there for 5 years. And just think about this. If all you see every morning you get up are poor people, if all you see when you get up in the morning are people who are struggling and are unemployed, that is inevitably going to have some impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
psychological impact. You're
yeah,
talking
psychological
about.
Impact. Mm-hmm. I've witnessed it, and so I'm trying now, because I'm in a position to try to do something about it, to solve some of the problems that we faced. And one of them was we had no choice. That's if you were poor and you had a job and you could pay a part of the subsidy, what the subsidy didn't pay to keep it and stay in your unit, you were still in a bad environment. And so now, back then we didn't have the opportunity to move to a non-project.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had to stay in the projects. Now, a person is able to move out of these areas into a middle-class neighborhood. Now, people might know that you're Section 8, but the people around you are not going to be all poor.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have, school teachers and lawyers and professionals, and that can impact one's view of themselves in the future.
We're going to have to leave our conversation right there. That's Missouri Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver from Missouri's 5th District, who represents Kansas City and areas to the east. Congressman, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Stay safe out there. Thanks for taking some time.
Good to be with you. North Kansas City girls won the state championship. We were talking about basketball earlier.
There you go.
Yes.
There you go. Well, Kay, you win the championship?
I don't think
so. Okay, I don't think so. Yeah, I'm not hearing a lot of enthusiasm. It doesn't look too good this year, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with Sarah McBride, who was the first transgender speaker at a major political convention when she spoke to the Democrats in Philadelphia in 2016. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, Netflix's reality show Queer Eye was filmed in and around the Kansas City area. We talked with one participant about his experience on that show. Hear the conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll find out how actors playing sick are helping UMKC's medical students prepare for real-life scenarios. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, for Sarah McBride, her biography is the story. In 2016, Sarah became the first transgender speaker at a major political convention when she spoke at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
My name is Sarah McBride, and I am a proud transgender American.
Today, she is a progressive activist and the national press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. That's the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. She was an intern in the Obama White House, was elected student body president as a sophomore at American University, and helped lead a successful effort to pass gender identity non-discrimination protections in Delaware. She's the author of Tomorrow Will Be Different, which chronicles her journey, and she'll be speaking at UMKC this week. Sarah McBride now joins me from WVUD in Newark, Delaware. Sarah, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So what's the greatest threat today to trans people?
Well, there are a number of significant threats facing the transgender community. Obviously, over the last 2 years, the Trump-Pence administration has sought to roll back the clock on our progress and target the transgender community for discrimination. But the challenges that face our community predate this administration as well. Even before January of 2017, a majority of states and the federal government still lacked clear protections from discrimination for LGBTQ people in employment and housing and public spaces. We're seeing a rise of hate-based violence against marginalized people of all backgrounds in this country, including transgender people. That's an increase that coincides with increasing vitriolic political debate. politicians all too eager to appeal to the darkest undercurrents of our society. There's no question that Donald Trump and Mike Pence are the most anti-transgender president and vice president in history. But the challenges are larger than them, and they are certainly a symptom of a greater problem of discrimination, of hate, of violence, and of a status quo that still does not protect transgender people and LGBTQ people more broadly.
You know, you refer to this here, but I mentioned in the opening that you helped lead the successful effort to pass gender identity non-discrimination protections in Delaware. How many states have laws at least the equal of Delaware's these days?
There are about 20 states in this country that protect LGBTQ people from discrimination in various parts of daily life, including employment and housing. But still, 30 states still lack clear protections for the community. The federal government still doesn't have those clear protections. Fortunately, last week we saw the Equality Act introduced in Congress, which is legislation that would provide gender identity and sexual orientation-based non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people in every state, in every area of life. And we hope and anticipate that that will get a majority vote in the House of Representatives in the coming months. But like I said, too many states still don't have those protections. But 20 states have stepped forward over the course of the last several decades to protect LGBTQ people from discrimination. And in every instance, there was fear-mongering, there were scare tactics by anti-equality opponents. And fortunately, in every single instance, we saw something not surprising but deeply profound, that LGBTQ people were treated with dignity and fairness. And that's what we're asking for nationwide.
Well, Missouri and Kansas are among the states that lack the protections you're talking about here. I'm wondering, what should activists out here know about the road ahead when it comes to pushing for these laws? You know, should they be comfortable waiting for federal action, or do they need to continue the push in the state capitals out here?
It's really an all-of-the-above approach. Mm-hmm. We certainly need federal protections, but we need people to be pushing for protections at the local and state level. Many municipalities, between 100 and 200, depending on the scope of the protections, have non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people. So we're seeing those protections move forward in municipalities across the country, not just in blue or even purple states, but in deep red states, in the deep South, for instance. So people should continue to push forward non-discrimination protections with their city councils and their town councils. They should continue to push forward statewide non-discrimination protections while simultaneously, unfortunately, having to beat back anti-LGBTQ policies and legislation that seek to license discrimination and, in some cases, mandate discrimination. But with every civil rights movement, the reality is that only so many states are going to take action, that at a certain point, the federal government has to step up and say, every person in every corner of this country deserves the same rights, that your rights shouldn't depend on which zip code you live in or which side of a state line you work on.
The lack of those protections, Sarah, means what?
The lack of these protections means that LGBTQ people are at risk of being fired from their job. They're at risk of being denied housing. They're at risk of being thrown out of a restaurant or refused access to a hotel or even critical health care services simply because of their gender identity or sexual orientation. And these possibilities, they're an everyday reality for far too many LGBTQ people, particularly in the states without protections. These protections provide explicit recourse for people if they face discrimination, but more importantly, they send a preemptive message to everyone that this is how our society and our government expect you to interact with and treat LGBTQ people. It's that we expect them to treat them the same way we treat everyone else, that we won't deny services, we won't deny employment based on identities.
Sarah McBride is my guest. She's the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. That's the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. To what extent, Sarah, have you seen a backlash since the 2015 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of same-sex marriage? A lot of people expected a backlash. Have we seen it to the extent that you anticipated?
You know, I think we definitely have seen anti-LGBTQ politicians post Obergefell, which was the Supreme Court decision that brought marriage equality to every state in this country. We've certainly seen a backlash from those anti-LGBTQ politicians who have sought to find the new boogie person. In the early 2000s, mid-2000s, anti-LGBTQ politicians used marriage equality as a political weapon meant to divide and hopefully in their instance conquer in the elections. With marriage equality off the table, they sought out other boogie people, whether that was licensing discrimination against same-sex couples under the guise of religious freedom, whether it was banning transgender people like myself from restrooms consistent with our gender identity. They tried to move on to new issues. But I think what's actually really profound is that these anti-LGBTQ politicians, whether it's Donald Trump in the White House or former Governor Pat McCrory in North Carolina, I think they dramatically overestimate the support for their policies and dramatically underestimate the support for equality. And I think what we've seen is after the marriage equality decision, support for not just marriage, but LGBTQ equality in general across issues continues to grow. And we actually see every single time they come for us, every single time the politics of backlash and of fear and of hate come for the LGBTQ community, when we make some sort of progress, we end up having a conversation with the country that serves to open hearts, change minds, and in the end, it sows the seeds of the destruction of the politics of backlash and hate that they seek to implement. And it actually ends up moving the conversation further and further toward equality.
You know, I'm wondering about your own story. You waited until college to come out. Why did it take you that long?
You know, my gender identity is something that I've known about, something about myself that I've known for as long as I can remember. But as a young person, for so long, I wondered and worried whether the heart of this country was big enough to love someone like me. I feared that my dreams of finding love, of living in this great state of Delaware, of being able to pursue my passions and my dreams, that those were mutually exclusive with who I am. I was a voracious reader of history as a kid, and as I read the history books, at the same time that I was becoming aware of this fact about me that society didn't approve of, I marveled at the scope of social change that filled those history books pages. But I also became aware very quickly of the fact that no one quite like me had ever made it very far. And so I kept my gender identity inside for the first 21 years of my life because I feared rejection. I feared discrimination. I feared violence. I feared that I would meet a world that was not ready to support and accept me. As much as I knew my own orbit, my own family would be there, I worried about the broader world. But eventually, the pain became too much. I think one of the challenges we have in the fight for trans equality that differs from conversations around sexual orientation and gay rights is that most people who are straight can understand what it feels like to love and to lust. So they're able to enter into conversations around sexual orientation with analogous experiences. But I think the challenge in the fight for trans rights is that most people who aren't transgender don't have an analogous experience to having a gender identity that differs from your sex assigned at birth. And for me, the closest thing that I can compare it to was a constant feeling of homesickness, an unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that would only go away when I could be seen and affirmed as myself. And for 21 years, my dreams won out over that pain, but eventually it became too much and the pain won out, and I had to take the only option that was available, which was to come out and live authentically.
You know, you gave a TED Talk in 2016 where you told the story that as a kid growing up, you'd go to bed at night and pray that you'd wake up as a girl. Is it fair to say that that was your secret and your secret alone?
Yeah, it was my deepest, deepest secret. I did not confide in a single person for 21 years because I knew the moment I confided in someone else was the moment I'd be admitting it to myself. And I wasn't ready and I was too scared. I knew who I was, but I was frightened by the world, so frightened by the world that I chose to keep it inside. But again, it became too much for me and it becomes too much for so many people, which is why they come out. And the reality is we shouldn't be requiring people through fear and worry about safety and their dignity to have to live significant portions of their lives hiding.
I'm just wondering, you know, as a kid at age 10, if that kid could see Sarah McBride today, you know, what you would have thought about that. I mean, what an incredible transformation you've been through.
I think about that a lot. When I was 10 years old, it was about the same time I first heard the word transgender. I was watching a sitcom with my mom, and a guest character who was played by the beautiful Jenny McCarthy was introduced into the episode. And the reveal about a quarter of the way through the episode was that she was transgender. And I remember asking my mom, are there people like that? And she says, yes, they're called transgender. And my heart drops because in this one moment, I knew this life-affirming fact that there were other people like me, that there was something I could do about this fact. But in watching this show and in seeing society writ large, I also knew what it would mean. And every time a character on the show would express any kind of romantic interest in this character, the laugh track would cue. And at 10 mm-hmm. years old, you don't know a lot, but you know you don't want to be a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And so to go from a place where my only reference points for trans people were as a punchline in a comedy or a dead body in a drama, to now 15 years, 18 years later, to be living in a world where there are transgender people who are, as Laverne Cox says, possibility models for so many young people is incredible. And I think, you know, for me, I wish I could go back and just say, whatever timeline you're on, whatever journey this looks like, you should know that in the end it's going to be okay. That you will have a family that loves you, that you will have friends that love you, that you will have a community that supports you, that it's going to be okay. And I think for me, one of the most inspiring things is that I get in my job with the Human Rights Campaign to meet so many young transgender people today who are doing what once seemed so impossible to me. They are both living their truth and dreaming big dreams all at the same time. And the mere fact that these young people exist today demonstrates how far we've come.
Sarah McBride is the featured speaker at UMKC's Pride Breakfast. It'll be 7:30 Thursday morning at the Swinney Recreation Center on campus. Tickets at umkc.edu/pride. I was going to say, do you think trans people are feeling more empowered these days to come out at a younger age, you know, even in high school? What are you seeing out there when it comes to that?
Yeah, there's no question that through the advancements in social acceptance, in science and medicine, and in legal equality, advancements in terms of access to information through the internet and through popular culture, television, and movies, more and more people are recognizing that they aren't alone, that there are other people like them, and are feeling empowered to come out. So we're seeing more and more young people come out. We're seeing more and more adults come out. We're seeing more and more people recognize that there's a space in this world for them. And that's a beautiful thing. Every generation is defined by widening the circle of opportunity, by seeing people who for too long remained in the shadows. And right now we're in a really pivotal inflection point when it comes to transgender people in this country. And we're seeing more and more people come out. But, you know, the reality is also that as more people come out, a greater spotlight is shown on the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, it's a sign of progress. But it also results in politicians who seek to divide, politicians who seek to leverage fear and hate to win elections. It puts a spotlight on our community. And and I think that's, you know, in many ways what we've seen is we've seen those anti-equality politicians shift to the trans community, shift to us. But again, I think what we're seeing is that people aren't falling for it this time. People, and I think maybe it's partly because we're part of the LGBTQ community, so the lesson learned from marriage equality is being applied in this case, which is that a lot of people support marriage equality now, overwhelming majorities. But a lot of those people didn't support marriage equality 5, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they go, you know what? I regret being wrong. I regret having been on the wrong side of history because I didn't understand it. And this conversation around trans equality is bubbling up. And I'm in the same boat. I don't totally understand it. I can't quite wrap my mind around it. It seems new and different to me. But I remember being on the wrong side before, and I don't want to be on the wrong side of history again. Mm-hmm. And so people are saying, you know what? I do need to know more. I do need to learn. I don't know a lot, but I do know that discrimination never wears well in history, and I know that kindness is always the right answer. Mm-hmm.
Sarah McBride is my guest. She's the first transgender speaker at a major political convention. She spoke to the Democrats in 2016 out in Philadelphia. You know, in your TED Talk, you brought up something I had never anticipated, which is this notion that you talked about being totally unprepared to deal with the sexism that came your way. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, I was always someone before I came out who tried to think about the isms and the phobias in the world. And you know, I knew that sexism and misogyny was a massive issue that was pervasive. But I think I was so consumed with the fear around the transphobia that I would face that mm-hmm. I wasn't totally prepared
right.
for the sexism and the misogyny. And it was truly everywhere, from the subtle to the blatant, this world of double standards and contradictions. I mean, the idea that If I'm not smiling, I'm told to smile. And if I am smiling, it's a special invitation for more comments.
Meaning you're walking down the street. Come on, baby, smile. Show me something. Right. That kind of thing.
Right. And then on the flip side, if I am smiling, it invites more comments. On the similarly, women are treated like both a delicate infant and a sexualized idol in the exact same moment. Right there, it's just this world of double standards, this world of contradictions, this world where every single decision you make impacts how you're going to be judged, whether you're safe, how people are going to interact with you. And I don't think people who are not part of that identity community, whether it's women or whether it's white people and communities of color, when you're not in the marginalized community, you don't realize just how many decisions a person has to make every single day to avoid 1,000 judgments, to avoid risk of discrimination or even violence. And that's, I think, a really profound reflection of the fact that for so many people in this country, for so many people in this world, they have to navigate. They don't have to. They can't just exist. Before I came out, I could just sort of, as much as I was struggling internally, I could kind of just exist. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to think about how the perceptions of my identity would be viewed and then impacted in terms of behavior in the world around me. And then when I came out, I had to go from experiencing the world to navigating the world. And I don't think people recognize that just how stressful and how significant that experience is. And it's actually demonstrated through research in something called minority stress, which is just the sheer stress that marginalized people experience in having to navigate a world structured against their lives and their success.
You know, I just have about a minute left. I mentioned you're the author of this new book, Tomorrow Will Be Different. And in the book, you made a decision to never reveal your birth name. And I'm wondering why.
You know, it's certainly a fact that people can Google about me. So it's not, you know, it's not something that's totally secret or totally hidden. And I'm comfortable with that. But the reason why in the book I decided not to do it, it is twofold. One, when people gain that information, you can almost tell that they begin to sort of detransition you in their mind, starting to see you not as who you are in that moment, but who you maybe were perceived as in the world before. And I think it's a dehumanizing feeling to know that the moment a person gets that piece of information, they're no longer seeing you. They're no longer seeing the person right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that so often our names we're given at birth are used as weapons against us, that people seek to weaponize them to diminish or dehumanize. Mm. And names and pronouns are the most frequent way we not only affirm a person's gender, but affirm a person's humanity. It's why when bullies want to bully not just trans people, but anyone else, they replace pronouns, human pronouns, with the word it, and they replace a person's name with slurs or with mockery. And governments do that too. When they want to oppress, they take away names, they take away pronouns, and refer to people as numbers. And so these are strategies that are used not just to target trans people, but to mock, ridicule, and marginalize people of all different kinds of backgrounds. And so when our names and our pronouns aren't affirmed, it's a very, very clear message that we are not fully human.
Right.
We are not being seen.
Sarah's book, Tomorrow Will Be Different. She's a featured speaker at UMKC's Pride Breakfast, 7:30 Thursday morning. Tickets, umkc.edu/pride. Sarah, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.